You're listening to Voice Actor Showcase, episode number 36.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to Voice Actor Showcase, a podcast about voice actors and their stories. Today, we'll meet a voice actor from Las Vegas. A kind, supportive, and driven individual, he's been making steady progress in his pursuit of success in voice acting. Thanks to his determination, talent, and dedicated work ethics, he has experienced numerous wins in his career and continues to push towards his goal. Please welcome Luis Bermudez.
What is this?
Please. Do calm yourself, Master Dwarf. You aren't in any danger. At least, not at the moment.
Hey, and what would you call this? A first date?
Possibly. That depends entirely on your standards, I think.
Ah, and there you are. I have an idea of what's happening now. Now that I can see you in the light, monster.
Yes, well, tonight, my dear tightly bound friend, I get to play a very different role. You will have to forgive me for being hesitant to reveal my appearance. I simply fear that if I did, I would hear no end of your protests.
Believe me, creature. You've yet to hear the full breadth of my protest.
Then it is true. You grave clerics do not fear death.
Well, but how did you know?
You smell of ash, which tells me you've killed my kind recently. I also recognize the shears on your belt. Akaza Metsis. Interesting line of work, delivering children. Your hands seem ill-suited to its delicate nature. Tell me. Do the babes often cry when you snip their cords?
I will not endure this line of questioning. Demon, if you are to kill me, do it. Whoa. Hey, what is that sound?
Monster, creature, demon, come now, Master Dwarf. You and I are not so different. We were both born in the dark, deep beneath the earth, and far away from the sun's touch. You, deep in the heart of Jormunganda. I, 10 feet in the soil. When you were born, you were ripped from your mother's womb. And when your cord was cut, you cried out. I tore myself out of my womb and had no such cord to cut. But I did scream.
Luis Bermudez, hello, welcome to the show, how are you?
Is this really how we're going to start?
Yes, it is.
Full on maitre d'.
Introducing Luis Bermudez, Saturday Night Live.
Jesus Christ. Hello, hi, I'm here. I have arrived.
How are you faring in this crazy heat wave we're having right now?
I'm not. it's hit like
what?
Every day this week I feel has hit close to 115.
Oh, God.
And like just like a few miles out of us in Death Valley, it's like 130. So it's terrible, man. Like, especially because the last few days I've had 4-hour recording sessions where I just sit down, I bang out everything I need to do for that day, and then I'm done. It's by the time I'm out, it's like I feel like I'm a character out of Mad Max. Like, it's ridiculous. I'm exhausted.
Losing crazy amount of water and sweat and salt.
Oh, my God. I can't drink enough water. Like, I cannot drink enough water.
That's harsh. That's harsh.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's really rough. It's really.
Well, now that I know that you're doing well, let's move right along.
Yeah.
tell me about the beginning, the very beginning. And I ask everyone this question. Tell me about the little Luis. What were some fun things that you like to do? Tell me about family and growing up and stuff like that. What are some fun stories from that time?
Cool. So my childhood and fun stories typically don't don't mix together very well, but I'll do my best. I was born a human male. What am I doing? Okay. I was born to two parents, my mother, Gladys Bermudez, and my father, Luis Bermudez, who were Cuban immigrants from Havana. And I don't know where exactly I picked up the performance bug, because nobody in my family prior had really done anything like this or pursued acting in any way or performance or the stage or anything like that. But I picked it up. I kind of just grew up. I grew up without my dad in the house a lot, because of who he was as a person, how that didn't mingle with other people. And so I found a lot of comfort in media and stories and anything that I could get my hands on that I could kind of disappear into, because everything around me was not as great. My mother was a single mother for most of her life, raising three kids, two of them girls, one of them black. So that was difficult, because already in Nevada, at least at the time that we were here, in the early 90s, it wasn't like terrible, but it's not like, you know, like my for instance, I was having a discussion with somebody the other day where they asked me kind of where I discovered performance. And for me, it was in high school. And for most people who jump into this, it's like, oh, I went to a play with my parents when I was a kid, when I was 4 years old, and I saw the Fosse Bougère and was like, I'm going to be naked on stage one day. But for me, it was like, I was 15. I just got my first girlfriend, and like my voice was changing. It was weirdly awkward.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, when I was a kid, we had a lot of precautions and barriers put on what we could and couldn't do. So like my sisters were not allowed to go out at night. They weren't allowed to really kind of hang out after school and after school programs because, you know, being Latina and also being, you know, mixed, you know, my father was black, my mother was white, that put a huge target on their back. If somebody wanted to do something crazy, it would be to them, you know. Like the only thing that would have brought them higher on the total pole is if they were also LGBTQ. So like, you know what I mean? Like that's the only way they would have had a bigger target.
Yeah.
So it was a difficult time, man. But I was raised by three incredibly talented, dedicated, focused, career-driven women. And my dad was around long enough to teach me how to throw a right hook, and that was pretty much it. So,
I mean, yeah, that I resonate with that story. Literally, when I came here, my God, middle school, the hormones are raging, and every boy needs to prove that he's a man, and it's the mid-90s stuff, you know? And it was the first kid that I threw over my shoulder in Taekwondo style and nailed him on the floor. It got me the respect that I deserved.
Right, exactly. It's like prison rules. You got to beat up the biggest kid in the yard.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so glad we don't live in that society anymore. That's for sure.
Yeah, Jesus.
Is growing up in Vegas different than other childhoods?
I would say so, just because, like, I mean, it's not like we're walking, I mean, I was about to say, it's not like we're walking around and there's like prostitutes on every corner, but I mean, sometimes there's prostitutes on every corner. I mean, it's a city driven by sex, and that's what sells everything out here. You know, everything that you look on, whether it's like a cup holster or fucking like a tea cozy, it has a naked woman on it or something, you know, to sexualize the female image, because everybody gets this idea. I mean, it's a city built by gangsters, you know, in the 20s. Yeah. So like everything here, this is supposed to be an oasis for people who don't have a conscience or don't want to have a conscience for a weekend. And I saw a lot of that working in security and just kind of, you know, dealing with working girls every night. You know, it's a city driven by sex. So it's very difficult as a child who, you know, my dad wasn't great about hiding that stuff from me anyway. You know, he had his paraphernalia easily accessible all throughout the house, much like most fathers do. I don't know why. I don't know why we're incapable of hiding our shit, but like, he couldn't. And it pervades kind of everything that you do. And so at a very young age, I had full comprehension of like the full human reproductive system because you just can't get away from it, you know? And so you're like, you have all these 7-year-olds running around like saying the most heinous shit. And you're just like, you don't even know what a fallopian tube is. Calm down, sir. Get out of here. You can point to a diagram where the fallopian tube is. So it's different for sure in a lot of ways, but I think it's the same as any metropolitan area, you know? You have the same pitfalls as any big city, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I'd agree with that. I mean, the concept of birds and the bees, I mean, what?
yeah, exactly. It wasn't so much that. It was just like, so the neighbors are loud, and I have to explain this to you now.
Oh, my.
That was kind of how it was going. Yeah.
Well, what were some favorite things from school? Subjects or activities, extracurriculars, so on and so forth.
Oh, man, I really loved – I was actually talking to my my girlfriend the other day about this. I really loved history, and it sucked because I was really good at it too, and I had teachers who just – they hated me. They hated me. I don't know why. I think it was because, like, they would hand me a test, and then 5 minutes later I would get up and give it back to them with, like, a 90% clear rate. Like, it was – and they were sick of it. It was just like, listen – it's like, unless you're going to hand me 100 paper, don't get up 5 minutes after I've given my lecture and hand me a 90 paper because that just makes me look like an asshole. But it was just because I dug it, man. Like, if something about the human experience has always been incredibly interesting to me, I just learning who people were and then seeing the trajectory of their lives and finding the weird little like nuances about their lives, like Alexander Hamilton, because I just watched the musical recently. There's numerous documentation about what he was doing, you know, the moments before he got shot by Aaron Burr and then eventually died. And it's talking about how he's sitting there looking at his gun and he's staring down the barrel of it and inspecting his gun meticulously. And it's because it's the same gun that he gave to his son years later, right, and his son died during that process. So it's I've always found a lot of poetic irony in people's normal lives that as a kid, again, I latched on to stories. So even if it was a real life story, I latched on to it. And there was something more visceral about that because it was more realistic. You know, it was more attainable. So history was really cool. English was also really cool. I didn't do super good in school. Like, I wasn't an academic learner at all. Like, you could put a book in front of me and I could study it and read it and eventually memorize the answers you needed me to give you.
Sure.
Right? But, like, when it came down to actually sitting down and learning something, comprehending something, that was something that I never really latched onto. English was probably the closest thing to that because reading and comprehension all came to me very naturally. Like, It was like fifth grade or third grade. I had done a reading language test. And, you know, the test where you click through and they're like, read this sentence and tell us what you think is happening in the sentence. And they use it to kind of get an idea of what your comprehension skills are, of what you're reading.
Right.
And I sat there. I think by the time I was done, there was three other kids in the classroom and then they left. And it was still just me and the teacher. And the teacher was like, are you just taking extra time? And when she came over to my desk and she saw that I was 400 questions in, she was like, you have a college grade reading level and you're 10. What the hell? She's like, what is going on?
Sitting there still, yeah.
And I was like, I don't know. You told me to take the test until I failed and I have not failed yet. You brought me here. So it was, and that later on translated to my ability to cold read. Like, I can look at a script and in 5 seconds have an interpretation of that script in three different ways because when my reading comprehension is just, and I don't know what it is cognitively. I couldn't explain it to you scientifically, but when I look at a piece of paper, I can see what is there and just digest that without any issue. So English was a really big point of interest for me. I hated science because we cut open frogs once and that was the worst. Like, until you cut open a frog and like formaldehyde squeezes out of its stomach and into your eyeball, like you don't look at, like, that's what makes or breaks a scientist right there. Just like, did you get the juice in your eyeball? Nope, you're going to be a scientist because it's going to be pretty cool to you now. But if you got the juice in your eyeball, now you're not going to want to do this because it's going to be a lot of juice in your eyeball for the rest of your career.
I have a funny story for you.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I cut open the frog was in school? Was in fifth grade, I think. Fifth or sixth grade, I forget. It was in Korea. And I distinctly remember sitting in the science lab where the teacher brought in this giant cylindrical container with a shallow pool of chloroform, some kind of an agent that knocks the frogs out.
And whatever the juice was that squirted in my eye.
So the teacher reached in and got frogs out who were and then laid them out on the table tray thingies, and we followed very specific directions on the operation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I, to this day, to this very day, very vividly remember the tiny little heart.
Yeah.
That's beating still.
Yeah, no, man. It's not a good time. It's not a good time. It's not a good time. And they're just like, now open its chest cavity. And I'm just like, nah. How about no? How about I don't do that? How about I'm 7 and we do literally fucking anything else that isn't traumatic and scarring? Jesus. Hey, you're 12. Face your mortality. It's
here,
like,
you
no,
go.
Man. Like, Jesus. It's really intense. Like, I love science. Like, I love silence on a practical matter, right? When somebody can, like, drop a bowling ball and a feather at the same time and they fall differently, I'm like, oh, yeah. That's cool.
That's awesome.
But when they're just like, hey, do you want to see what the inside of you looks like? I'm just like, nah, I'm good with that being a mystery for the rest of my life, actually. I get freaked out when people show me x-rays. I'm just like, nah, man. I don't want to know I have bones. Get that out of here. I am one solid unit of person. That's it. I'm like a chocolate bar. You bite into me, that's it. There's no nougaty filling, nothing.
And just as sweet.
Yes. Yeah.
on that note, I guess. That very happy, chocolatey, sweet note. What happens after high school?
Oh, man. After high school, so, I mean, to kind of talk about what happened after high school, I got to go back a little bit into high school. During high school, at least during my junior and senior year, I was taking part in theater program, and I was also working part-time. Because, again, my mother was single, and at the time, she was dating a fucking deadbeat, whatever. I had to get a job at 16 years of age. So I got a worker's permit in Nevada because you have to when you're that young. They're like, why are you working? And I'm just like, oh, the world sucks. And they're just like, okay, all right. Here's this piece of paper that says you can't.
Same here. Yeah. Go on.
So I got a job and I was working through high school. I ended up having to switch to homeschooling because I was working. I needed to work so much that I couldn't attend regular school. So instead I did an online alternative where I went to school online 5 days a week or 4 days a week and then went in person 1 day a week. And that worked better with my schedule. But I had to leave theater because of that. So that was a big blow for me because that was kind of – before that, that was kind of the only – outlet I had had. And that was the first, that was like the first hit, man. That was like the first time you experience that thing that gives you light like nothing else does. And when I had to leave, it was really heartbreaking because, you know, I had been told, oh, you go to this charter school and then they'll let you come here for extracurriculars to get extra credits. And it didn't work that way. So then I graduated out of high school after kind of gaining back some credits from after, you know, I'd worked so much. I'd lost credits in my junior year. So I had to regain like several credits in my senior year. But because I was working so much, they took that and applied it to credits. So I graduated full honors, accredited school, 3.5 GPA, and I was good. After that, I just kind of bounced around the workforce. I didn't really go into community theater. I didn't start doing improv. I didn't chase acting at all.
Yeah.
I just became a rank and file member of the blue collar workforce, and I got jobs everywhere. I got jobs in retail. I got jobs in sales. I got jobs in warehouses. Because I'm a bigger dude, so I was able to do, you know, I was able to do a lot. And then I was going through a really terrible time. I was going through a couple really terrible breakups with really terrible people.
Ugh.
And I had hit like the lowest point of my life. And I had started watching this show called Deadliest Catch. And a family member of mine, Torian Robinson, he's a really good dude. He's introduced me to this idea of Alaskan seafood processing. And it's basically the same thing. It's basically the same thing as Deadliest Catch. You go out in the middle of Alaska on a boat, anywhere from a 50-foot boat to a 300-foot boat, and you work on a boat for several months at a time, fishing for whatever's in the ocean. And after talking to him briefly, I took a couple trips out to Seattle. I networked with some of the people that he worked with. I obviously didn't land a job with them because they wanted more experienced fish hands, because it's a very hard job. Yeah, it's like when you're talking about like a hard job, it's not like, oh, I worked in the construction in the sun all day. It's like, no, I worked 16 hours, you know, for 3 months straight, no days off, most of the time lifting 50 pounds or more above my head every single day. Geez. It was physically breaking is what it was. It's taking a human on the edge of what they can manage physically and then keeping them there for an extended period of time. And they didn't want to hire me. So I came back home. I kept applying because I knew this was something that I wanted to do. Because for me, the military wasn't an option. I just, being a brown kid in America, you don't feel like fighting for a country that wouldn't mourn you if you died. And so military wasn't an option for me. So I kept looking for something else that could, you know, everyone goes through a crucible in their life, I think. Right. They go through this moment where it's make or break. It's you throw yourself against the chaos and you dare it to break you. And you find out what you're capable of in that moment. And I needed that because I was going through so much emotional and mental turmoil that I needed something to kind of break me out of that cycle. And I got a job with Icicle Seafoods, and I worked on their ship, the RM Thorstensen, for 3 months in the summer of 2013. We fished for salmon, and we were supposed to be out there for 2 months. It got extended, and we worked out there for 3 months. And by the time I came back, I had a minor fracture in my ankle. I had what I'm discovering now is nerve and tendon damage on my ankles and feet from standing for so long. And I have slipped discs in my back that are now affecting my nerves. I get twitches in my eyeball every now and again because of the amount of stress that I was putting my body under while I was out there. But that all being said, it was one of the most eye-opening experiences of my life. And regardless of all the stuff I came back with it, I'm grateful that I did it. You know, it helped me see what I needed to see about myself and helped me appreciate how strong I was, because I wasn't aware how strong I was until that moment.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, sorry. My bad.
No, don't apologize.
Was that for like the later half of the podcast?
That is one heck of a story. I mean, what the hell? You worked on an Alaskan fishing ship?
Yeah, for 3 months.
Jesus.
It was a lot, man. It was a lot.
How old are you?
I was, at the time, I think I was 18 or 19, maybe.
Oh, young. My gosh.
Yeah. I was like a baby. I couldn't even grow a beard yet. I was a kid, man. And there was other kids on there, which was the crazy thing. I made a few friends on there who I'm no longer really friends with now because, you know, we were all from different parts of the world. So we all got separated. But it was a cultural melting pot. And like, yeah, I was really, really young. I'm trying to remember anything else.
Walk us through a typical 24 hours, briefly.
Sure, yeah. So you wake up in your shack. It's a small – it's. I mean, we called them jack shacks because they're small.
Yeah.
Small cots. I'm going to be fucking honest about it. Well, they're small cots, all right? And they're bolted into the wall. It's basically like you're sleeping inside of a dresser drawer. And it's 2 by 6 foot, you know.
Ooh.
So it's like a coffin. And then the only thing that gives you any kind of semblance of privacy is this small little blue curtain that you can kind of tug over the side of it. And that's why we call it jack shacks, because if the curtain was closed, someone was sleeping or someone was jacking.
Yes. I see.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bunch of dudes on a boat, man. What are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do?
Explicit episode it is. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so you sleep on that fucking godforsaken thing. And, like, the mattress you're on is about the same quality as any prison mattress I've ever seen. It's, like, a little bit of down inside of what feels like two sewn-together bed sheets. You have a pillow that's barely a pillow. And then whatever you brought home with you. You know, guys would put pictures of their girlfriends up above their heads. They would put, you know, pictures of Jesus. And just, like, you could always tell who somebody was just by looking at the top of their cot. Because they would have anything that could get them through what hell they were living in.
Wow.
Hung right above their head. They wanted that to be the first thing they saw in the morning. I didn't have anything like that. I went out there with a Nintendo DS. With a Nintendo DS and Fire Emblem. I can't even remember which version it was. I think it was like Spirit Awakening or some shit. I did that. So you wake up after sleeping for 4 hours. You go down to the galley. If your stomach can take it, you eat anything you can. It doesn't matter what it is, because you don't have time to really eat anything at this time of day. You have to run down, get on your rain gear, and then get into the factory and work. For me, my daily process was get up, eat an apple that I would cover in peanut butter, and that was my breakfast. I would go downstairs, and then I would take my hands, put them in the liners. Bear in mind, they're completely stiff. I can't close or open my hands at all.
Oh, wow.
And I would walk over to the side railing of the boat and slam my knuckles against the railing until my wrists and hands would unlock, essentially. Because the tendons were so fucking taut. It literally felt like I was cracking ice.
Wow.
And then you walk over to your rain gear. You put on the rest of your rain gear, probably like 10 to 15 pounds of extra gear to protect you from the rain and wet and slosh and goo that's coming off of these fucking disgusting, vile fish. I love salmon. I love salmon sushi, by the way. If you show me a salmon with a face, I will have a Nom-like flashback.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, don't. Just don't. Just don't bring a salmon face near me. I looked in their eyes, and I wondered where their families were. Leave it there. I was just like, Is your cousin with you? And then, like, another fish would land on top of them, and I was just like, nope, there he is. You're together. It's fine. Okay, I'm going to put you in a pan. Like, you think of really messed up stuff when you're down there. So you get your rain gear on. You walk into the factory. It's deafening because the hopper is a fucking – it's a 3,000-ton piece of machinery that loads fish into it and then spits them out at a lightning-fast pace. And everything is slimy. Everything is wet. Everything smells terrible. There's fish guts and a guy pulling apart roe from the intestines of these animals, you know, because roe is extremely expensive. Then you go and you work your shift. And then depending on where you work in the factory, sometimes you have what they call dry and wet shifts. So 8 hours of the day, you will work in a dry area where you're taking frozen fish and putting them in a box. And that's like your chill time, right? Because you're not getting wet. You're not getting all this goop on you. You're chilling. Maybe you're listening to music and dancing with your friends. Like, it's cool. Then the other half of your day is wet work. And you're either on the slime table, what they call the slime table. Essentially, you take a thick butter knife and you grab the fish that have been pushed through the hopper and cut open. And you scrape all of their intestines out. The guys on the slime table, to give you an idea, we had yellow rain gear. The guys on the slime table had red rain gear by the end of the day. Covered in viscera and gore and just gross. I was not lucky enough to have my days split. I had 16 hours of wet work. So I went into the cart loading area because, again, I was a bigger guy. So I'm standing next to all these Samoan dudes who are like 7 feet tall, like 400 pounds of solid muscle. Like, these guys could grab an orca out of the ocean if they wanted to, you think. And I'm just standing there. Like a beefy Cuban dude, still 5'8". Like, cool, 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 cool. Yeah, I'm going to work with these guys. Tight, 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 tight. And fish come, you know, spraying down this belt into your tray. And you have to take those fish, put them into a smaller tray in an organized fashion so that they can be put into a freezer and frozen. The problem is You have to lift that tray after it's full, and it weighs 50 to 60 pounds, depending on the kinds of fish you put on there. If you're new at this, it probably weighs closer to 70 to 80 pounds because you're putting bigger fish on there than you need to. Like, the thing you learn in cart loading week three is that, oh, fuck, I can put three. The smaller fish. I can put the smaller fish with the bigger fish and it won't be a problem. Great. So week one and two, I was lifting 80-pound, you know, tins of these slimy, slippery fish. And every time you did it, there was a chance you could fuck it up. Like, your hand would slip, the pan would fall on the floor, 25 fish would go slippering across the floor, somebody would fall and die. It was a nightmare. It was a nightmare.
Wow.
And you had to do that for 16 hours straight. So lifting 50 pounds above your head, going down to the ground because the lower part of the cart also needs to be filled, going down to the ground and squatting with 50 pounds in your hands. It was a lot.
Jeez.
I went out there. I think I was at the time, I was like 180. I came back 220. And I wasn't even fatter. I had just gained so much muscle mass.
Muscle, yeah.
Yeah. And when you, the kind of stuff you eat out there, all they feed you is a variation of chicken, beef, or pork. They're just like, what kind of protein do you want today? And it was not healthy. It was not like sustainable, but it was whatever you could get in you during your hour lunch break and then back to work. So it was brutal, man. It was absolutely brutal.
You know, I once worked at a sandwich shop and I hated it.
You say a sandwich shop? Yeah. Yeah, that's the same. Let's talk about that for 35 minutes.
The spread, the mayo just right. And standing there is just, ah.
Yeah. But you know what, man? I also worked in plenty of sandwich shops. And fuck those jobs. Straight up. Like, working in fast food is a different kind of hell. It's actually funny, too, because, like, okay, I'm Cuban. Just get the elephant out of the room. Speaking of sandwich shops, it was really funny growing up as a kid because, like, everyone's just like, oh, like, your dad must be like Scarface. And you want to get defensive as a Cuban kid because you're like, no, fuck it. Sometimes we just wear clothes that's too tight. It's sure. we're not all drug addicts and sellers. Like, calm down. My dad was 100% Scarface. He worked in a sandwich shop when he first came here, and then he started selling cocaine.
Oh, no.
It was like, and they would be like, your dad's like Scarface. And I was like, you're right, but I'll fight you in this courtyard anyway.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So speaking of sandwich shop, I just had to get that out of the way because it's the funniest fucking thing.
All right. So refresh my memory not to mess with you. That's okay.
Yeah.
Wow. How has the working in the fishing industry changed you?
I think it just okay. The kid that went out there died out there. I firmly believe that. Something about going through as much pain as you can physically withstand and coming out on the other end of it, surviving it, makes you realize, it does one of two things. It either fucks you up for the rest of your life, and I'm definitely messed up. I have issues from it. I have night terrors. I wake up sweating sometimes because I dream that I'm on the boat. But the other half of that, the other side of that, is it makes you realize that literally nothing besides divine right could stop you in your tracks if you wanted it to. I have no doubt in my mind that if I put my mind to something and I focus on something, that thing will be mine because I'm tenacious, I'm relentless, I am tireless. If I desire something, it is going to be mine by the time I'm done desiring it because I went through a period in my life where I felt like nothing belonged to me. I felt like I didn't deserve anything. I felt like I was here as a cosmic joke to make some grander entity laugh at me trying to find happiness. And after that, I thought to myself, I dare it to fucking try and take it. The only way I got through that season was a lot of prayer to my various gods, which is another podcast. My various gods coming out September. But a lot of that and waking up every single day and telling myself, you know, every day fucking sucks, but every day is the same. And if I can get through today, then tomorrow is just a repeat. If I can get through today, I can get through the season. And I told myself that every single day. If I can get through today, I can get through the season. I smashed my foot. I can get through today. I can get through the season. I broke my ankle on day three. If I can get through today, I can get through the season. And that was what kind of carried me through. So when you get that mentality of how to survive, you don't let go of it. And I think that's like not to be that guy, but like I think that's why I've been so successful during the whole pandemic is because every day really is the same. You wake up in your apartment or your home or wherever you live.
Yeah.
And you go through the motions and that's it. And there's nothing new or exciting. You're not seeing your friends. In my case, I'm not even seeing my family because I can't risk making my 60-year-old mother sick, even though she lives right around the corner from me. I can't risk taking this to her, you know?
Yeah.
But you tell yourself every single day, if I can get through today, then tomorrow isn't a challenge. And that's it. And you just keep going. And I think a lot of people, they get so stuck in the, oh my God, I'm just living. It's like Groundhog Day. I'm living in a cycle. And if you tell yourself the only thing that's allowing that to happen is you, then you can push past that. So I think what Alaska, the person that came out of Alaska is somebody who is perfectly aware of his capabilities, perfectly aware of what he can withstand and what he can't. I know where my limits are. I know who I am. More importantly, I know who I am and what I stand for. And I know what I want to do with my life. And I having that singular focus, that like laser guided intuition is invaluable. That's why, like, regardless of whatever I went through going out there and whatever I've gone through coming back from it, it's a gift and a curse. You know, it's like when Odin tore out his eyes so that he could get all the knowledge in the world. You know, nothing comes without a price. Nothing good comes without a price, and anything worth having is worth suffering for. You know, and that's kind of what I came out of it with.
Wow. I mean, it's quite a story. First and foremost, it's inspiring. You know, I mean, not many people at that age, especially, goes through life defining and certainly life changing in a very significant way down to the core of one's being in that capacity at that age. I mean, it's a gift and a curse. Absolutely right about that. Yeah. I think. Wow.
Yeah.
And how does that determined person who came out of Alaska eventually transition himself into voiceover work?
I mean, that's the thing is like, everyone tells me like, you know, or not tells me. No one talks to me. When you listen, shit. When you listen to like these podcasts, like for me, it was Talking Tunes, right? That was the first kind of thing that I like really dived into like later on in my life with Rob Paulsen. You know, you hear all these actors talk about like, I had no idea you could be a voice in cartoons or that you could act as a living. No, I was from the age of 8. I was uniquely aware that there were people behind the cartoons talking. I knew that people on screen were doing a job. And I wanted in on that. Like I saw that. I mean, the first thing I remember as a kid was watching The Matrix with my dad. And my dad, the only thing I loved about my dad was that he was a kung fu movie fanatic. Like he showed me Bruce Lee, he showed me Jackie Chan, he showed me, you know, Jet Li, all these, you know, Donnie Yen, he showed me all these really talented people of color. And they were fucking killing it. Like Bruce Lee was everywhere. Jackie Chan was everywhere. Jet Li was everywhere. Yeah. And it was these guys who would otherwise be a joke at the time, right? Absolutely destroying the movie industry and making it their own and saying, look, we're not going back to Chuck Norris wearing cowboy boots, beating the shit out of other white guys. We're going to beat the shit
Steven
out of the white
Seagal
guys.
Stuff.
Yeah.
That's right.
And it was like, it was so amazing. And so like you see, I saw Keanu Reeves, this mixed person, you know, with dark hair like mine, dark eyes like mine, a complexion similar to mine, like just doing all the stuff I wanted to do. He was fighting robots. He learned kung fu. Like, he was hanging out with this super cool black guy. Like, I was like, yes, this is what I want my life to be. This is a hunt. I was like, my dad is Morpheus. I'm Neo. This is it. This is it. I've made it. I have made it. So I started wearing leather jackets, and I started slicking my hair back, and I developed this stupid walk that my dad taught me, because that was my first, like, yes, introduction into play. You know, that was my first introduction into, like, pretend. Yeah. And so now it wasn't like I was watching The Matrix. I was Neo.
Yeah.
And I went around my house pretending that I was Neo, and I would do the bat, like, I was dodging bullets when my sisters were talking to me, and they were just like, stop, go take a shower. You haven't showered in 3 days. You're 9 years old and disgusting. And I was just like, oh, Neo, don't, you can't stop. I'm the chosen one. And it was ridiculous.
Whoa, yeah, whoa. Be good to each other. Be excellent to each other, bro.
It was stupid. It was so stupid. But that was the first thing, man. That was that first, like, time that I really started to pretend. And then that continued. Yeah. I mean, that continued all the way up until I got into high school. Then I jumped into theater. I met my mentor, Patrick Shimpak. He guided me towards what acting actually was. And he was like, look, you're a great pretender. Let me teach you how to act. And it wasn't like he sat down with me, like, you know, like the guy who taught, you know, Machiavelli had a right, but like he gave this colored kid a name on his playbill, and he gave him a lead role, and he said, look, you're good, go up there and be good. And that was like, from there, it was just like, I was obsessed. And so everything that I did, every job that I got after that, it was like, yeah, I work at Nautica, but I'm an actor. Yeah, I work in Alaska, but I'm an actor. And I never said that out loud, but in my head, I'm like, I'm an actor. I am an actor. I'm an actor. Because every time I watched something, I couldn't just watch it. I had to dissect it. Anytime I watched a film or I watched an actor that I enjoyed perform, I sat there and went, oh, my God, like the choices that they're making. You know, I couldn't just watch it as an audience member. I couldn't just be somebody like, oh, man, Robert Downey Jr. sure does play this guy a lot. Like, I couldn't be that dude. I was just like, yeah, Robert Downey Jr. is playing the same character, but there's little nuances of each character that you're missing that you're not paying attention to, you know? So I was uniquely aware of acting being a profession from a very young age. And then as I got older, the interest became an obsession. So after Alaska, you know, I lived that experience where it was like, look, man, I so to go back to Alaska for a second, there was a storm while we were out there. A lot of things happened while we were out there that were crazy. But there was a storm that happened while we were out there. And I'm talking about, like, not like, oh, man, it's raining a little bit. I'm talking about like 50 foot swells of water that send the boat look like, oh, like it's vertical almost.
Oh,
and
my God.
It was insane. But I got up in the middle of the night and I walked to the stern of the ship, which is the back of the ship for people who don't know boats. And I opened up a hatch that said, do not open during high storms, during a high storm.
Oh.
And I was thrown into a rail, and luckily I didn't go overboard. I wasn't cast off the ship, but I'm holding onto this rail, getting absolutely battered by wind and rain. And I'm looking out at how absolutely brutal and unforgiving and uncaring nature is. And I'm looking at waves bigger than my ship. And I'm there like, I could die any moment. That's what I got from it. I could be taken away by one of these waves literally any second.
Jeez.
What am I fucking doing on this boat? And so I came back home and I was like, nah, man, like that's it. Anything that I want from now on, I am going to pursue it relentlessly because it's what I deserve. And it's because I need to have it. So yeah. I bought Uri Lowenthal and Tara Platt's book, Voice Over Voice Actor, the first edition of it. When I had come back again, I was much bigger, so I went right into security work. I started working as a security officer, and I had this job where I could kind of sit in a booth, very similar to what I do now, sit in a booth by myself in a chair, wearing a uniform, and nobody would be watching me. So I would sit down and I would digest these podcasts. I would go on to Chuck Duran's Vo Buzz Weekly. I would watch that religiously. I would watch Talking Tunes. I would jump on Talking Heads when that was still a thing on Geek and Sundry. And then Critical Role happened. And I was already a huge Pathfinder player. I played Pathfinder RPG, which is like 3.5 D&D, which is basically the same system that Matthew Mercer and his friends were playing before they started the stream. And it was like watching my friends come to life on TV, but as totally different people. And it was like, oh, so like, I already have the skill set, because I was doing that every week. Like, my friends would get together, and whether it was like in their apartment, my apartment, a park, because we didn't have anywhere we could go. We were kids. We didn't have any money. We didn't have jobs. So like, we got together whenever we could and we played pretend, and I was doing the same stuff that Matthew Mercer was doing. I'm not going to say I was doing it before he was. I'm just saying like I was doing to a degree what he was doing. I was voicing these characters, and I was doing accents, and I was embodying people to scratch that itch because I had no other outlet for it. And when I saw Critical Role, it was like a flip switch, and it was like, oh, I've already taken all the like beginner classes. I'm at the level where I can now start pursuing this realistically. And so I remember the first person I reached out to was Sarah Sakura on Twitter, because at the time she had her YouTube channel, AV Gaming. And I was a huge fan of that because it was a girl playing video games, which you didn't see often. And it wasn't like, she wasn't like the kind of entertainer where it was like, I'm a girl and I'm using my feminine wiles to, you know, bring people in, which there's nothing wrong with, but it was just different. And it wasn't toxic in the comments because it was just people watching a girl play video games, you know, and joining those other streams, you know, you're there for 5 minutes before somebody's just like, take your top off. And then you're like, oh, fuck's sake, dude. Enjoy this human being enjoying the thing that they're enjoying without you being a piece of shit.
There's that guy. Yep.
And I watched Sarah play video games, and then she started chasing voiceover. And I think a year later into her journey, I had asked her, I had finally gotten the balls, and I was like, hey, I know this is super unprofessional. I know this isn't the way you're supposed to do it, but I don't know how to go about doing it. And I think my first question was like, how do like taxes work when you're a voiceover artist? I was putting the horse like way above, like way before the wagon. She was like, have you worked yet? And I was like, nah. she was so nice. She was like, go to iwanttobeavoiceactor.com. Go to that website, read everything you can on there. Here's where I took some classes. She gave me the GVAA website. She's like, take some classes there if you're really interested, but understand that this is a business. You have to invest into this. This isn't just like, oh, I picked this up and I go. And I totally understood that and respected where she was coming from. So I was just like, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking literally any time to respond to my stupid questions at all. I am going to fuck off now for 5 years and then come back on Twitter and be a voice actor. And that was literally how it happened. I left. I found, you know, I found a good teacher. I found resources everywhere that I could. And I just absorbed everything. And a lot of what I learned was from the Voice Acting Club Facebook page, because there's a lot of, and say what you want about Facebook and voice actors on there, there's a lot that have, you know, very strong personalities. But these were professionals who were telling people like, hey, you know, you can absolutely, you know, pursue this job in a realistic fashion, but you've got to pursue it like a business. And I think what I did was in February of 2018. Yeah, 2018, 2017. I don't know. One of those 2 years. No, 20. It would have been. I don't know. approximately a year to 2 years ago, I went up to my best friend who was at the time going to school to be an audio engineer. And I said, hey, man, show me how to use a DAW. Like, let me borrow your shitty AT2020 that's been dropped a million times and your Steinberg UR12 that the head port is jiggly on. I'm going to build a blanket fort in my fucking bedroom and I'm going to start recording auditions and I'm going to be a voice actor. And I built this rinky dink little booth at the time. I had like a piece of plywood that I drilled into the wall to make a desk. And I had a shitty CRT TV that I put in here so I could cast my laptop to it. And I started working, man. I got on CCC and I just hit the pavement. And very quickly, nice. I learned the pavement was riddled with Sonic redubs and Mega Man fan animations. And I was like, this is maybe not what I was hoping for. But I booked my first like real gig on there. And it just kind of continued. I met Melissa Medina. I met her through that website. She was at the time, she was producing a podcast called XY Podcast. And I hope she returns to it because it was amazing at the time and still is. But it was, you know, it was that first time where like somebody who was at a level that I wished I could be saw what I did and was like, dude, you are really good. She was like, your audition stood up above anybody else's for this character. And I didn't get that role, but what was important was that she invited me to play. And I got an invitation to her Discord server, and it was like being let in on the inner circle, man. It was like I was – suddenly this world had opened up in front of me, and I was with my people. I was back in theater in high school, and I was joking with these absolute numbskulls about stupid, inane voice acting stuff because they got it. And then I found out about Twitter. And I jumped on Twitter and I started getting active on Twitter and, you know, I started networking with people and finding out who was working and finding out who was doing good work and following them to kind of, you know, follow in their footsteps. And that's why I say, like, surround yourself with people that are better than you, because if you surround yourself with if you grab your four closest friends who are all as good as you and you cheer each other on, that's awesome. But surround yourself with people that are better than you exponentially. Like, I still follow people to this day, like Rico Fajardo, like Yuri Lowenthal, like Tara Platt, who are just leagues beyond me as far as talent goes. But I want to see what they're doing so that I can know what's working, because I want to understand and get in the heads of people who are doing this successfully. You know, I want to surround myself not just with their success so I can lift them up when they've done something amazing, because they do it frequently, but I want to absorb, you know, that energy from them. I want to get that vibe from them so I can understand it better. And that's what Twitter was. It was just this way to network, talk to people about stuff, and like gas people up when they did something cool. Because for me, the coolest thing in the world is that we get to do this. The coolest thing is that we get to sit down with our friends and play pretend and make stupid stuff. And some of it is really, really good. And these people are all incredibly talented. And they're all – what's cool is they're all getting like professional demo reels now. Like Anjali, she just made a demo reel and it's literally the best demo reel I've heard on this site. And I'm talking about like as far as like professionals that I've heard, like people who are already in this industry. And it's like – it just opens you up to so much more talent and makes you realize that the only barrier really is like state lines. And other than that, there's no reason for these people to be unknown. You know what I mean? There's no reason for people to be like, well, we're having trouble finding, you know, East Asian or South Asian actors. It's like, bullshit. Open your eyes. What are you talking about? Like, where are you looking? Are you looking at the same talent roster that you've had for 40 years? Because that's probably why. That's probably why. I'm going to be honest with you. Talent isn't hard to find. It's never hard to find. It's just how hard you're willing to look for it. And that was what Twitter was, man. It was a way for me to look for incredibly good talent and just kind of absorb what they were doing.
I agree. Anjali's demo was fabulous, absolutely amazing. And yeah. And I think there's some truth to be said about Twitter VO or online VO of today. I mean, especially propelled by the coronavirus. I mean, the remote connectivity like Source Connect has become so accessible and rather mainstream now. I mean, we used to have to deal with IPDTL and and phone patch and all these things, but Source Connect has really changed everything. And there's you're right, there's talent to be found everywhere. And there's no more excuses for any production to not cast properly, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think even, I mean, the thing that is important to say, too, is that none of this is like new technology. Source Connect was around before the coronavirus. You know, they just couldn't support the volume that they're supporting now, obviously. And I think they're still, based on yesterday, they're still having some growing pains. So, you know, they're doing the best they can. But, like, there have been people working remotely for decades now. And most non-union talent that I know work out of their homes. You know what I mean? Like, you go on the Facebook pages and these people like Terry Daniels, Mark Preston, Mark Scott, George Whittam, Mike Delgadio, all these huge guys have home studios that they've built themselves or had professionally built. And this is their game, you know? And those were the guys that I learned and took cues from because I'm in Vegas. Like, I don't have the funds to just drop everything and go spend $2,000 a month on expenses in LA or move to Texas and get shot. I don't know what's going to happen when I go to Texas. You know what I mean? Like, whatever. I don't know. I'm not saying anything about people in Texas, but I'm a little worried, you know?
Now I think you should be.
Yeah, I'm a little apprehensive about going to Texas. I don't know what's down there. I hear you guys have great food and awesome weather. I think that's cool. I'm just a little, you know, but like, Texas is great. just say that out loud. Texas is wonderful. Don't come for me, Michael Zekas. Please don't listen to this podcast. but you know, remote talent have been doing this forever. And that has been, I've never set foot in a professional studio ever. Like, I have never recorded anything inside of a professional studio. I've recorded four professional studios inside of my home studio. I've recorded now national commercials inside of my home studio. But I've never set foot inside of, you know, what they consider a broadcast quality area to record this kind of work in. And so I've never had that experience. But when coronavirus did start, you know, there were people who came to me that I was kind of already on the radar of who were just like, hey, man, I've got this thing that I'd love for you to read for. You know, we've got this actor who just can't figure out their setup. And it's unfortunate, but that's kind of the name of the game now. It is you have to understand what it is that your sound engineers need and what it is that your studios need. You know, do you have a negative 60 dB floor? Do you have, you know, the ability to run a webcam a webcam, a mic, maybe two mics at the same time, a monitor, an iPad, and everything you need to do ADR dubbing with your computer out of the room so the fan noise isn't in the recording? Do you have that capability? And if you don't, can you get it? And so the second the pandemic hit, it was like all this money I was holding on to for that rainy day, I was like, that's it.
Yep.
This is it. I went out. I spent maybe $2,000 on extra stuff for my booth because I wanted to be capable. I wanted to have the right mic. I wanted to have the right setup. I wanted to have the right noise floor. I wanted to have everything that I needed to record and work, whatever I needed to do. In here, I got a ring light and a 1080p. I got the Logitech C90 Pro or whatever this stupid thing is, so that I could record video for clients who want to do face matching and do mocap if that's something that they need to do. Because the name of the game now is adaptability, and if you can't adapt, I'm sorry to say you're not going to be successful in this. And it's not just about spending money, right? It is. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to lie to anybody and tell anyone, hey, you know, you could do what I'm doing with a Scarlett, you know, a Scarlett 2i2 and an AT2020. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not working with that hardware. I'm not working with the same limitations as other people are. But do I think you can put out quality work? Absolutely. If you make that your goal, if you make that your focus and your goal is to put out quality work and be a quality voice talent, You can do that with as little stuff as possible. I don't have a studio bricks like you do, you know, but I'm still working. And I think that's what people are learning now, is that the only thing stopping you from being successful in this is how tenacious you are, you know, how experimental you're willing to be, you know. Am I willing to jump into my closet and suffer 115 degree weather to record for this dream studio that I've always wanted to work with? Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like no questions asked. I don't care if I pass out after the session. I will be in there. I will be in there doing my job, because this is all I have ever wanted. This is all that's ever been on the bucket list. Like, people want to go skydiving. They want to go see the Grand Canyon. No. Fuck that. Put me behind a mic. I just want to be characters. I just want to act. That's it. And if you give me that opportunity, you let me come in and play, that's it. That's it. You know, I'll do anything you ask me to do. And I think a lot of talent had trouble with that starting out, because it's not their fault that they don't know what is good audio quality. You know, like, you saw these actors kind of come out of L.A., who, you know, now they have a more remote presence on online and all this stuff, because it's kind of where you have to exist now. And these poor people are like struggling with like, what's a good interface? What's a good mic? And they have no idea, because they never asked those questions. But the people who ask those questions, the people who are like, hey, just so I know, like, what DAW are you using? Oh, Pro Tools? Cool. All right, cool. What's good about Pro Tools? And if you ask those questions to the right people, you have that information. It's not like it's hard to find, you know? And it's, I think that's what's facilitated all these remote talent coming up, because, you know, we were always there, but now people are forced to look at us because they have to broaden their horizons, beyond what they've known and what they've been comfortable with. And that's not, you know, to cast aspersions on LA based actors or on casting people. But I think everyone can agree that up until now, the industry has been maybe a little too hard to break into for people who have every ability and capability to do so.
Huh. It was L.A., New York, Chicago, Atlanta.
Yeah, exactly. And Texas, if you wanted to do anime.
And right. And that's what it was, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And if you weren't in those areas, sorry, you know. People like Richard Reed and Reese Bridger have absolutely no reason. Like, there's no reason why their portfolios are not as stellar as some of the talent that are out here. And I'm going to say that whole fucking heartily with my whole chest. Those guys should be working way more, you know, because they're so good at what they do. And it has nothing to do with their region code, you know. And I think that's what studios are learning, is just like, I would rather have an actor that knows how to use Source Connect on a session than an actor that's never worked with it before. And I think that's, you know, that's why at the beginning of all this too, I like plugged a couple of different books from friends of mine who are engineers and told people like, hey, learn this stuff, because you never know when it's going to become valuable information. You know, you never know when an engineer is going to be like, hey, can you put a hard limit on something? Or, hey, can you run a high pass filter so we can get rid of some of that low frequency rumble? You know, you never know when that's going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know how to do it, it's not going to hurt you. I mean, I don't think it is, but I don't know. If somebody tells you, hey, can you do this thing? And the answer is no, I just feel like that's less opportunities. Like, why not make that answer a yes instead and seek out that knowledge so that you can make that answer a yes and say, yes, I can do that for you. Like, people who don't know how to run phone patch, get a fucking Google phone account. Get a Google phone account. And you don't know, I don't care that you don't have a DSL connection. Get a Google phone account. Give them the number. You don't have to tell them where they're calling into. It's not like they give a shit. Just give them the number and they'll call you and you can get that job. You know what I mean? So it's stuff like that that gets under my skin, because it's like, it's so easily accessible for people. And we as voice actors, I think you've seen a lot of the discourse where people are like, you know, as a voice actor, you got to seek out your own information. But then some of those people you see in like forums with their engineer buddies, and they're just like, how do I press record in Audacity? And I'm like, I need you to talk less. I need you to smile more and talk less. You're the only one who can do the opposite of Aaron Burr's advice. like Christ. And I'm sorry, that's just a big point for me, because I feel like there's a lot of talent out there that's so good, and I want them to be working more, because they're amazing. They are amazing, and there's too many people who like jump on stream with all of their white voice actor friends, and I'm tired of seeing it, man. I'm tired of seeing all white casts. I'm tired. I just want to see some melanated skin and some accented people doing good work. That's it. That's all I want.
It's not much to ask for.
Yeah.
I don't think
so.
Especially in today's climate.
Mm-hmm.